Hello, and a really warm welcome to our podcast, Successful Student Transitions, A Time to Thrive, hosted by Louise Wiles and me, Elizabeth Gillis. In our podcast, we aim to be a companion for young people as they step out of the school into the world of work and study and help them thrive in new environments. We've had a focus recently on the first year of university, hearing from students what it's like for them in that first term. And if it interests you, go back and listen to their stories about that transition to university, because they've got a wealth of wisdom to share. And we want to acknowledge that some students might find this move to university a challenge. So today we're talking with Scarlett about being neurodiverse and her university experiences, So she's got a wealth of experience in further education with two undergraduate degrees and currently studying for a PhD. So a lot of time in this higher education. So welcome to you, Scarlett. And I'm going to ask you first to share about what you're up to in terms of what you're doing alongside your studies. And then we're going to talk about your experience of navigating systems and structures in higher education and how this informs your consultancy and the training that you deliver. So welcome to you, Scarlett.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
And Scarlett, so tell us a little bit about you, what you're doing at the moment. You've got your doctorate going on, and what else?
So I'm currently a consultant for NAESN and more recently Special Networks. And recently that's involved delivering a project for autistic children for the LEGO Foundation, developing accessible, inclusive education and educational technology. We do a lot of training with schools and companies on sensory environments and inclusive measures, universal design. And yeah, sometimes we create some kind of white paper reports on recommendations and things like that. So yeah, I'm really enjoying it. It's a really nice accompaniment to quite dry doctoral project. So yeah,
your doctorate isn't on this at all. It's on,
it's no, on... Yeah, it's very niche. My doctorate's on law and literature and coastlines and how we can protect them. So yeah, two completely different avenues.
So a very nice balance. And the work around neurodiversity. Why are you doing that, Scarlett? Why has that come up for you?
And mainly, I've just been really enjoying working as a lived experience advisor on large projects. I often find that the other people I work with who are also autistic can deliver quite a direct, shrewd analysis of the things that need to be done. So I'm enjoying getting down to business with large corporations, essentially, and telling them what to do. So yeah, that's really enjoyable. And also just sharing my experience with schools and employers as well has been quite, healing, I suppose, as well. Yeah.
Because you've had a journey, you know, we'll say that word, haven't you, Scarlett, in that you went to university without a diagnosis and then got a diagnosis of autism in your second year. Do you want to... Tell us.
Yeah, I can tell you about that. Yeah, so I went to university in 2017 and I lasted a year on my undergrad English literature course, and I ended up dropping out because I got the dates wrong on my Excel sheet of exams and didn't turn up to two. I made a series of quite bad decisions about my accommodation and where I was living, which contributed to quite a tough time for my mental health. So I ended up leaving and I didn't know what to do for the year. So I ended up, first of all, buying a dog, which was an ill-advised decision, but ended up being one of the best decisions ever for myself. And we both moved to Finland for a year, where we worked in kind of farm work. We supported a disabled woman and I worked in a flea market for a year. So some very random series of employments in that year. And I really enjoyed myself and it gave me a lot of confidence kind of being alone and learning how to live alone and make that transition maybe into adulthood without the expectations of achieving quite high grades, just getting on with it. And I think that was a year that I probably should have had between school and university. I think that if I could go back, that would be the first thing I would have done, is take a year out in between.
Yeah. And that's an interest. We just had somebody on talking about having a gap year. They're not neurodiverse, but they said they chose it because they wanted to kind of find out things about themselves and to be able to learn to do things. So I think having a nice purpose for a gap year is good.
Yeah.
But you didn't know you were autistic when you were having that tough time at university, or did you?
I didn't at all, no. I just had a constant feeling that something was wrong with me often. It was the kind of same thing going on in my head all the time. So, yeah. So I knew something was going on. I was extremely anxious as well. I was in severe fight or flight mode for the whole year of my degree, the first year. So yeah, I didn't know at that point. And then when I returned from Finland, I had counselling with a local service and they signposted me towards that service. So yeah.
And you know how awful it is, I would imagine, to go to this thing, this university, have this experience that everybody tells you is going to be the greatest bit of your life and everything, and to feel it kind of unwind a bit on you. And I know when I've been talking and working with other young people who are neurodiverse, you know, that that risk of dropout in that first, having that first year to kind of like explore and do a lot of things, but the risk of dropout there is really high, isn't it? And missing small things, well, not small things, but missing things like dates and times and...
Yeah, it was. I think if you're already stressed over many other things, major things can slip through the cracks.
Yeah,
and yeah, it wasn't a pleasant experience. I wasn't known at all to any of the services. I was completely anonymous for that first year.
And did you know there were services available on that first year, or?
I haven't even thought to look. It wasn't. Yeah, I just thought I was messing up continuously, and it was my own problem. And because the things I was messing up on were so basic, it kind of, I hadn't even considered looking.
That is really tough, Scarlett, because then you are thinking, well, what's wrong with me, rather than, this is a new place I'm in. We were talking earlier, I have to learn to do things in a different way. I have to find out how I can do it.
Yeah.
When you got your diagnosis and you were back at university, what did anything change?
I knew at that point that I couldn't return in the same way that I had started university. So I just immediately went into problem solving mode. I wanted to finish my degree and I knew that I couldn't continue normally, quote unquote. So that's when I was actively looking for support and services from the university itself. And I knew that I wouldn't enjoy it if I didn't have my dog there. That was essential for me, I had realized in that year. So I got in contact with my university disability services, shout out to Oz, who was very helpful, and I just made a case. I made a huge autistic researched case for my return, well researched. I told them exactly what I wanted to happen and how I could work with them to make sure that happened. And I think that's where I actually first started to quite enjoy doing that kind of work, which is probably why I enjoy doing a lot of the consultancy stuff I do now, because it was really satisfying to go back to uni after that diagnosis and see all of the things I'd worked with them for in place and working successfully.
And Scarlett, being able to advocate for yourself like that, like, this is what I need from you, but I'm going to do it myself. So it was a kind of like a two-pronged approach, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was my first time doing that for myself. And yeah, it's helpful also for me to do that with a lot of kind of research backing behind me that made me personally feel, I feel like I probably went overkill with that, but it made me feel better to have that research and that kind of reasoning that I'd compiled behind me. So yeah, and actually it ended up working really well because the second year onwards is heavily coursework based. And the university, Goldsmiths, that I was with lets you do a practice submission of coursework before it gets graded for every single paper. So that second year was where I learned to write properly and allowed me to make mistakes and get better and better and better. And it's very, that way of learning, I think, is very neurodivergent friendly, which, you know, after that first year of exams, which I'm terrible at, I just got better and better and better at writing coursework. And so, yeah, it was quite easy second year onwards work-wise for me. It very much suited my brain.
So it's there's something about finding a course that kind of suits you in that way as well, isn't it? And finding the way that assessments work as well, because all assessments are kind of stressful. But...
Yeah, no, I think that... Yeah, having a coursework heavy degree program really changed the game for me in terms of success.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be able to attend a university that was exam heavy at all. So
knowing that about yourself and finding the place you can do it is a good strategy.
Definitely.
Tell us about your dog.
Yeah, I bought Pepper in a moment of madness from Gumtree. She was £150, which is kind of the standard price for dogs back then. And she was excellent. She, you know, I spent a lot of time in that year out enjoying training activities, working with local trainers, and she just worked really well. She learned things very quickly and was very good in public, and yeah, it was a huge comfort to have around, and I love being around animals a lot. So yeah, it was, yeah, she's very good. And I managed to train her up with the help of a local trainer and did a lot of work myself. Finally got her in to complete her own degrees. all three of them now.
Right.
So yeah, she's very good and was quite famous when we were there. I think we were there 5 years in total.
Nice. And how does she support you when you're at university?
She does quite a lot of very specific things. So one of the things I struggle with, or used to struggle with a lot, is when I used to get stressed, I used to get quite disoriented and not know where I was going. So we trained her to find a person, an exit, and I can't remember. Oh, she could deliver notes between people. So that was one of the main things that was quite useful to have, especially in busy areas. She could fetch things. She knew when I was skin picking or picking my hair, so that she was just trained to disrupt those kind of repetitive behaviors. Yeah, and just being her general sunny ginger self was lovely.
We need to take a photograph of her because people are listening.
She was great. She's retired now. She's 10. She's an old lady. But yeah, she was great. And she did do terrible toxic miasma farts sometimes in lectures, which were infamous with lecturers. So yeah, that actually made us, well, it didn't lose us any popularity, which was a surprise for us. But yeah.
It sounds like the university were very accepting of you with, I don't know what we'll call her, a support dog or a...
Yeah, so normally at that point in time, the main body of charities, which is called ADUK, kind of the official quote-unquote registry, you are legally allowed to train your own dog with the help of a trainer or yourself. They must meet certain standards and you must have a prescribed disability. But that's not a very well-known kind of subsection of the Equalities Act. Mm. So it was quite difficult at first to get their heads around it. But after a while, it was kind of plain sailing. Also, mainly because I had a barrage of information and documents and training logs and kind of organized policies, third-party liability insurance. So yeah, I, again, kind of, you know, approached that was...
You've done all the background work there.
Right? Yeah, a lot of work doing that as well. It took ages. So I'm lucky I had that a year to get that sorted.
Yeah. And it is about this thing about knowing what you need. And that's a tricky thing, because sometimes we don't know what we need when you're going off to university or something. But I guess in a way, you found it out. You found it after you were there.
Yeah, I'm still doing that now. I still doing this PhD as well. It's completely different kind of self-directed learning, much more so. And I've learned so much more about myself and what I need doing that as well, just continuously. I just think often time's against you when you're a young student, because like we said, you're expected to go off straight away and immediately know or fit into the study structure that they have there. And actually it might take you, in my case, I'm still learning, and it's been kind of 6 years in academia. I'm still learning what works and what doesn't work for me. So yeah, I definitely feel like there's a, you know, limited opportunity. But also I just think, you know, autistic people are super tenacious.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've finally got to where I wanted to be when I was 15 now. And I've got there, but I've taken some very sketchy U-turns on the way there. But I've still managed to do it. And I've got a friend as well who is very dyslexic, needs to use a scribe for everything. And she's the same year as me, and she's doing her PhD in plant science, but she still uses a scribe, you know, 100% of the time. So she's also got to where she wants to be, but very much through sheer dogged determination.
And sometimes leading the way, like it sounds that you have there.
Yeah, a lot of the time it's seeking out kind of less trodden paths to get places that other people might just get there in a straight line, it feels like. But yeah, it does happen, it does work.
and it is about being open to help and being able to kind of ask or advocate for this kind of help, because who knows what people say along the way. Because there is, I mean, you mentioned the disability support service that all universities will have. And, you know, when I kind of look online at different disability services at universities, they're all different.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's not a commonality among them all, like this university, all of them will offer this or all of them will offer that. So it's really important to think about, if you're going and choosing universities and you are neurodiverse, that's maybe one of the things to think about.
I think that would be one of my first things that I would have done, is I would have researched and grilled the disability service, you know, 6 months before I would have wanted to study at that institution, and been very visible to them before I arrived. I think that would have been something I would have done at that age.
Because if you get like into talking with people in the disability service, from my kind of experience of working with some young people, they can be really helpful, you know.
Yeah,
they've got themselves set up well, that, you know, sometimes they have somebody that is trained in supporting somebody with neurodiversity, you know, or a team of them. But I mean, there's lots of different things that can happen, they can offer lots of different things. Do you get any other kind of access arrangement or adjustments now or when you were at university? What kind of adjustments do you get at the moment, or do you know other people get?
At the moment, it's quite hard, because a lot of the work I'm doing is very geared towards my brain. So I'm not needing a lot of adjustments at the moment. What was offered to me that was very useful was a very interactive tour of the library, which I still struggle to use. I really dislike going into libraries. I find them difficult places to study and be in, strangely. So that was something I knew I needed and asked for. I have a bit more flexibility with deadlines. Often I can use it as special considerations for exams or coursework, which I don't really use. I mean, it's quite bad. In my master's and my undergrad, in terms of extension deadlines, it was something I was really kind of self-prejudiced to use. There's something about it that I really didn't like the idea of it. So the only time I've ever really used a deadline extension has been during the pandemic for my master's dissertation, during quite a tricky period. And I wish I'd used them before, but but I hadn't. So I think the other thing as well that I would suggest is, a lot of the time, it's not the accommodations that's the problem. It's a lot of the time it's your own internalized ableism or expectations that stops you from using your accommodations for a lot of the time. So learning what those have been and challenging those has been quite useful. At the moment, I do try and take my PhD at my own pace. Yeah, because there's quite a high, I get burnt out very quickly after doing quite large amounts of work. And luckily, my supervisors have learnt that that is kind of a natural scarlet regression, if that makes sense, is that I'll do with quite a large burst of work. And then maybe they won't hear from me for a couple of weeks. And I'll be back, you know, a bit more refreshed to do the next bit.
Have you ever had anybody that's been a kind of mentor support for you that kind of understands or even is autistic themselves? Sometimes the disability services will have an autism mentor or a buddy who's got a similar kind of, you know, condition or...
Yeah, my university does definitely offer kind of, they do one-off mentoring. They've got different disability support groups. We've got one for undergraduate neurodiversity. We've even got a neurodiversity society as well for people who want to meet up socially. We've got a staff neurodiversity group as well, which is quite good. I think it's nice to speak to people with institutional experience of neurodiversity, because a lot of the time academics and neurodiversity and neurodivergence is very much not compatible a lot of the time. So it's nice to have people with those two experiences together. But honestly, a lot of my network with friends, I mean, all of my friends are neurodivergent. So there's not been any trouble kind of seeking shared experiences between each other, being at university and being autistic.
And it's become kind of, I'm not going to say this, well, I don't know what word to say, but it becomes kind of like more talked about, more discussed, more open. There's maybe less of a stigma about it. I don't know. Because I know when people have said to me, oh, should I tell the university I go, yes.
I mean, I think it's, yeah, I think definitely. Always. It's always good to know in the background. I think the thing I get a lot is, you know, oh, you're not, you know, you don't look autistic, or, you know, you don't feel like you're autistic or whatever. But then inevitably they always get this kind of uncanny valley. I always see the uncanny valley kind of cross over their face during certain social interactions, where it's like, oh, actually, maybe that is true. So yeah, I think always useful. I think the other thing that happens as well with a lot of autistic people that go to uni with lower support needs, that maybe have quite high academic ambitions, I often find have this idea in their head that it's high grades or nothing. And as soon as that goes completely pear-shaped, it's mentally things start taking a quite dark turn. Often it's because they've got kind of a very fixed idea of what they're going to be doing when they're there. And also a lot of the time, you know, you've gone to university to study your special interest or something you're quite talented in. And sometimes it doesn't go the way you think it's going to go. And that's what you've been pinning your self-esteem up with for the past couple of years, 6 years, 10 years or so, and suddenly realizing that maybe that isn't going to work out for you can be quite devastating for teenagers or young people.
I agree, Scarlett. We had some people talking up from a university just about what they would expect from first year students, and they were saying, you know, forget 70%, you know, for ACE.
Yeah.
We're kind of thinking if people get 50% or something, that they're doing fine.
Yeah, I think that's
a whole readjustment too, isn't it?
Yeah, I think for me, if someone starts feeling that way for like 5 minutes, I think they're already in the danger zone for university. If that's the thought they're having for 5 minutes a day, that thought, you know, it's high grades or I shouldn't be here. That's an immediate cause for concern for me, I think, for autistic teenagers at university, young people.
So let's talk about, because you've had experience, you've had time and challenge, times of success, talking to other people about the structures that support neurodiverse people. If you could say, have a wish list about anything and say, this is what needs to happen when this, or these would be good things for young people and maybe universities to do it at this transition point when young adults are starting at university, what would you be thinking about?
I think I'd probably be thinking about supporting. I think it's all well and good having kind of support networks or groups, I think, for autistic people, students to meet up and discuss concerns and things like that. But there's also a lot of, I'd hate the word soft skills, but there's a lot of like very serious kind of
self-work, a very specific self-work
that would be very useful for autistic students to have a look at, I think. And things that are very specific, like burnout, for example. Like, I know my university does topic-specific and autistic-specific groups for topics such as this. I think that's quite useful, especially if you've gone to university like me and you weren't diagnosed till the first year. So you're completely new to knowing anything. I think universities need to stop being so scared about getting a bit more specific with their autism support. So a lot of them just kind of stop it. Putting some autistic people in a room together with a disability advisor, and that's the structure of the support. Actually, I think there needs to be much more specific things.
I like that very much, because I think burnout, it sounds like, you know, it can be this slow descent into, or it can be a rapid descent into just like, you know, complete overwhelm. And then there's that huge risk of dropping out, isn't there?
Yeah, I think that burnout's a really under researched and quite a huge actual phenomenon in an autistic person's life. And 100% is going to completely be the reason why someone drops out. So that needs to be talked about more. And other things as well, like thinking about like really basic things like scheduling, I think, stuff like that, really obvious things that other people might have already learned the skills of that you know, autistic people might not have done. And I think people also don't realize how important knowing how you're feeling is as well when you're going to university. If you don't have that set of skills or haven't properly developed that set of skills yet, you know, you're not going to know why you don't want to complete a university task. It just seems to be something that you avoid. Oh, why am I avoiding, you know, doing this large piece of coursework that's due tomorrow? And until you realize that the reason you're avoiding it is because you're super anxious about it because no one's broken down these specific steps. Yeah. You know, if you don't know that about yourself, you're going to be avoiding doing university work forever. So it's I think it's things like that I think need to be really mind mapped and about deeply, I think, for universities to look at. And I think we were talking earlier about approaching struggling students. Mm-hmm. I like to think about it kind of failing, you know, like when wildlife starts to fail for no reason. Oh, why is this, you know, bird not eating? Or, you know, why is she just repeatedly doing this bad decision? I think looking at all students through a neurodivergent lens, series of lenses, and then phasing them out as you're talking to them or thinking about them is going to be useful for even students that aren't neurodivergent. So I think that's also really important as well.
And likely that would have helped you, Scarlett, in that first year that you were at university.
Yeah, I think so. I think that would have been quicker to see, I think. And I think there is if a student has anxiety, is thinking about dropping out, you know, and these other things, I think the first thing I personally would think about is, oh, this student's probably, you know, neurodivergent. That's probably the first thing I would think about from my perspective. And I think the other thing as well is that we're talking about transitions. And one of the things I struggle with university-wise is there's a piece of research actually that UCL recently did on autistic people. And it's like the lack of self-reflection after each transition, I think, is a huge problem, especially with university work. So I know a lot of people will complete a big bit of work and they'll sit down and be like, oh, I was really proud of completing that. And that took a lot of strain on my brain and body. And, you know, I put in so many hours and, you know, I neglected to do this while I was doing this, that I sacrificed this fun activity for this work, but I'm really proud of how it turned out. I've never naturally experienced those thoughts after each large burst of activity or transition between work. And my first reaction is always, oh, thank God, it's over. And then it's straight onto the next piece of work. And there's no part in between of realizing how much strain that's taken and how well you did. And I think going between work, employment, university like that is very taxing if you don't have that small moment in between of thinking about the work you have just done.
And celebrating successes of how you've done it well or mistakes you've made and how to do it differently the next time.
Yeah, I think because it also that saves you so much time. You know, it saves you, you know, if you've made quite a significant number of mistakes in one piece of work and you haven't addressed them, you know, it's going to take you twice as long to do the next piece of work. But it's also, you know, a way of, I know a lot of autistic people have quite a lot of negative self-talk about things. You know, it's that nice kind of little ego boost of pride in between something you've done well, I think, that keeps your motivation going rather than just, you know, Mr. Blobbying between crashing through the university kind of task by task without really thinking about what you've done. So I'm always very diligent after each piece of work of kind of sitting myself down and talking those things through. I think that is very important.
And that's something incredibly kind of practical, isn't it, to do?
Yeah.
you had a mentor, they'd say, right, you've done the bit of work, that's it done, but just let's look at what was good about it, what you did well.
Yeah, that reflective, I think because that's something that a lot of autistic people don't naturally do at all. And it's taken me, you know, 6 years of my adult life. You know, I'm 27 this year. I've still only just learned to do that. And I think because it's quite common, I just think it's something that's such an easy way of, it's just an easy way of making sure people are supported on track. Because also those kind of questions, you know, what did you struggle with? And they might say something like, oh, I struggled with reading this really hard piece of, you know, that's a really good indication of somewhere where they might need support. So I think those reflective moments are quite important, I think.
Because they could say, because I mean, some, I was kind of looking through some university sites and looking at what was or what is currently on their disability service. I mean, sometimes there's proofreading support or there's...
Yeah, exactly.
You know, if you're right, if people are saying, you know, I'm really slow at reading through all those, the material that I have to, you know, get through. And so maybe you think, I wonder if they've got other kind of challenges in processing or something like that. So I think you're right, that reflection time can celebrate the positives and maybe help it happen again, but also point to areas where maybe there's gaps in support.
Yeah, I think also as well, like emotionally, I think a lot of autistic people struggle to know. You talk about kind of thresholds of dogs and trigger stacking, dog training, but I think it's appropriate here. Like I've only just learned how I've started to become much more curious about why I, you know, might be feeling a certain way after a very small event. And, you know, the downside is you realize that you're quite oversensitive to things, but it stopped you kind of moving in fight or flight mode throughout life, essentially constantly. If you're not picking up why certain things are making you anxious, essentially, you know, it could be anything. It could be building works while I was trying to study, you know, triggered on top of something else, on top of another demand, et cetera, et cetera. And that's contributing to, you know, university anxiety all day. Yeah. So it's, I think very much, I think reflection also helps with that aspect of things as well. Yeah.
Do you ever journal? Just out of interest, is that a journaling task to do or not?
Yeah, I think I like journaling to be a bit more structured. I'm quite practical a lot of the time. So if it's something that I know I'm not very good at, then I want to target specific things in the journal. So I have like very specific questions I'll ask myself after something. And yeah, I think a lot of the time I'm quite self-judgmental about the things that I'm feeling anxious about. I don't like to share them with other people because they can be completely, completely ridiculous. So yeah, I like to keep them to myself. And then also just being a little bit kinder, I think, sometimes towards yourself for those small things that might not affect other people but affect you a little bit more. So I think it's very much helped me kind of soothe myself a little bit more, I think, definitely.
I remember somebody asking me during the pandemic, what do you think people should learn? And I said, inner compassion.
Yeah, I think that's true. I really do. I think that's something that I haven't done at all. And I'm only just learning to do it now. And it's made quite a huge difference in my life. I think annoyingly, it's made me, I think it makes you more resilient emotionally, but also sometimes it's quite vulnerable to start doing that to yourself, isn't it? So,
don't know. That's another question. You know, Scarlett, this has been absolutely amazing listening to you talk about, you know, what you've learned about yourself, predominantly about how you've learned to use those words that you had earlier on the special networks page, navigate your way through things and find the things that work for you. I mean, I think it sounds like, and I know you're a person that perseveres and gets things done. And I think for a lot of people, they might be like that. And I worry about for the people that maybe sometimes find that a little bit more difficult. So it needs both those skills that you're saying that, you know, you're learning to kind of hone for yourself, that those skills are really important. And it also needs the kind of supportive structures around in a system.
Mm.
And maybe even in the system before you go to university, there needs to be something there to kind of say, let's not just get your exams that you need, but let's develop some other skills that you're going to need to have to navigate this new place.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that would make that self-discovery process as well so much shorter than it, you know, less long than it needs to be, for sure, to have that.
Maybe less agony.
Yeah. Yeah.
Scarlett, I wished you so well in your PhD. I'd love to read it, but likely I wouldn't understand a bit of it.
I don't even want to read it.
And I'd love to send some pictures of the dog because we've got a website. Maybe we can put them
up there. Sure.
You're so impressive.
Oh, thank you.
That you got to where you wanted to get to by maybe not that linear route that everybody thinks that they need to go on, but you've had some, you know, little side roots in Finland and buying dogs and having a very rich picture of what you're doing. So thank you for sharing your journey.
Thank you for having me and, you know, talking it through. I really enjoyed it.
Take care. Thank you very much.
Wow, thank you, Scarlett, for so generously and openly sharing your journey, your experience and insights. I know that this is going to be a really helpful listen for other neurodivergent students, whether they're already at university or considering whether they're going to go to university or preparing to begin and start. So here's a quick summary of the key takeaways from this conversation. So the first thing, Scarlett talked about the importance of research. She reminded us to take time to carefully research the way in which universities support neurodivergent students and to do this well in advance of making your university choice and then taking up your place. Secondly, she suggested that you talk to the university's disability service well in advance of arriving and ensure that they are aware of you, your needs, and how you feel they can best support you in the early days. And thirdly, remember that your needs will evolve once you arrive. So be prepared to reflect on that. And most importantly, be ready to communicate and advocate for yourself. Fourthly, and I think this is a point for parents, schools and colleges who may be listening, you know, I think this conversation with Scarlett prompts us to think about how we support neurodivergent students to be able to communicate their needs and to be ready for this kind of self-advocacy, supporting them to build the skills needed to communicate their requirements for support. And the fifth point, finally, Scarlett also emphasised the importance of focused support for autistic students. She talked about need for focus and support around burnout, scheduling work, noticing patterns of avoidance and developing self-reflection skills. So we hope that you enjoyed this episode and found it useful. Once again, thank you so much, Scarlett. We're going to be back next week with a new episode. Meanwhile, please help us to spread the word about this episode and the podcast generally with your friends, colleagues, and families. We would really appreciate that support. Have a great week. Bye-bye for now. And now for the legal bits. The information contained in this podcast is for information purposes only. The content is not intended to act as a substitute for professional advice. Please do not delay in seeking professional help for any medical or mental health condition. Use of the information in this podcast and associated materials is at the user's own risk.